This is a presentation from the Supernaut Network.
Welcome to the Imaginarium, the show where art and passions for creativity meet, creating a conversation that can only be found in the Imaginarium. I'm your host, Scott Colbert, and this week's guest is someone who's previously appeared on the Supernauts. He's a writer, playwright, director, bon vivant, gadfly, man about town, and a friend of mine for the last, I won't tell you how many long years it's been, Joe
it's
Adams.
Decades. It's decades.
Decades, yes. Oh, yeah. Well, welcome to Imaginarium, Joe.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let's start at the beginning. Supernauts, you talked about working in an art museum and then going into journalism and working.
No, I was not working in an art museum. I was a painter that was having gallery shows. And by the time I was 18, I was selling paintings. I made money from an art gallery, but I didn't work there.
Okay. All right. Since we have that clarification.
Okay.
What was the leap from going from being a painter to working for the newspapers?
Oh, this isn't going to be good. I think I stopped painting because I was becoming successful at it. I lived most of my life with a very negative script that was very, very self-defeating. And in each of my careers, I've done things other people try to do for their whole lives, and then I get into it, I get successful at it, and then stop. So the big thing about all of my careers have dealt with communication. The big thing about changing from art to journalism, and at the same time, I was a journalism major and a drama major, it was still communication. My paintings and a couple of sculptures, I worked hard to make them communicate. And the first time I went to someone's house and saw one of my paintings on their wall, I was shocked. And my first impression, seriously, was they are awfully nice. They took pity on me and bought one of my paintings. And that's seriously how I took that experience. So I think I'm able to not do that these days because I've been in a rut for a long time. So for me, that rut is success.
That's always the tough thing, is being able to deal with success, even on small scale things, is at least as far as I'm concerned. You know, I get a little success, and then, holy shit, somebody likes what I do. I better screw this up somehow.
Yeah. And I now understand where that came from, because the way I was raised and the life I lived up until about the age of 35 was it was dangerous to be visible. So with a newspaper, you're pretty well invisible. No one sees you when they read your work. I loved radio because you were invisible. I hated acting, but I loved directing and producing because you're not on stage and people don't look at you. So trying to be present, communicating, and invisible is a very difficult job.
Is there anything specific that you've been trying to communicate? Because, you know, as you said, everything that you've ever done has dealt with communication. So is there some, like a message that you've been trying to get out through all that communication?
Well, I did not realize it until years later as I started getting more into my spiritual side. People like Gandhi and the Dalai Lama and all that defined what I was already doing. And that was compassion. Other people's pain is real. And you don't have to fix it, but you should listen and validate. My communications have always been about breaking lies, destroying lies. And there's a very old theory of theater from Greece that said comedy is the story of a lie sustained. Drama, it's my computer agreeing with me. Drama is the story of the lie exposed. And to me, the highest drama is dealing with the aftermath of the lie. So compassion and truth are the things that I did not realize had driven me all my life, but they have.
Let's talk about your radio years, because that's always a lot of fun.
I did that for probably the longest. I did that one for 10 years.
And that was with your partner, Greg Roebuck.
Greg Roebuck, who is currently in the VA hospital in Westwood out in California. He just had another birthday. He's not doing real well. And he was my fellow traveler for 20 plus years. And when we hooked up again, we are just on the same wavelength. It's just we haven't talked to each other for a while. And we have stayed back in touch with each other for another 10 years.
I understand that pattern.
Yeah. Well, there's something different in you and me.
That's true.
You had told me you were dying, and I believed you, and actually memorialized you in climbing the spiral mountain with our little apartment there on Thomas.
As a matter of fact, that apartment building is no longer there.
I went by on, I used Google Maps to drive down streets, and there's a children's hospital on the block there, but I thought I saw the building there, but that was about 3 years ago.
Yeah, I looked it up, I guess maybe it was a few months ago, and it was no longer there. The children's hospital looks like it expanded.
Okay.
And of course, I haven't been down to that part of town in forever.
When I lived there, that children's hospital was a very bad, dirty, vacant lot. And it was the first time I saw a dust devil. I was leaving the apartment and I was working in Scottsdale. And I looked over to the right, and there are like these three kids, Latino, maybe Mexican, maybe not, I don't know. But there was a dust devil, which is a tiny little tornado that was maybe 15 feet high, stirring up the dust and turning it into a cone of whirling sand. And these kids were playing in the dust devil. It was incredible. I loved it.
Yeah, they've actually really done a lot to revitalize that particular area. And but it's kind of sad, and it's interesting. A lot of the places that I frequented back in the early 80s and to late 80s have been torn down. I mean, every single bar that I ever used to go to before I quit drinking has been torn down.
Yeah.
So I can only assume that because I'm no longer drinking, they went out of business.
Yeah, that's right. If you weren't coming out paying them, they couldn't pay their bills anymore. It's your fault. Actually, what I've done, I've lived all over the country, mostly in parts of California, in Phoenix, in Denver, West Virginia. Now I'm in North Carolina. And I have used Google Maps to drive down the streets where I used to live. And I'm shocked. Inglewood, California is supposed to be like a whole other, you know, nasty hood. And I went to where I used to live on Brett Street, and actually the neighborhood doesn't look any different. And the people on the street were not scary, and there wasn't graffiti everywhere. It was a nice little working class neighborhood. It's just who lives there is different. And the streets are different because the police came in and changed the streets so you could not drive all the way through. You got into these loops where if you were turning, you couldn't go straight. You had to turn left or right. And if you turned left or right, they knew where to cut you off. So apparently it had a history of really bad gang stuff, but now it's not too bad. I went down Sunset Boulevard on Google Maps, and I don't recognize 50% of it. A lot of the places where I used to live are gone. Some of them are still there, but they're all, you know, protected by fences and window guards and electric alarms and stuff like that. I really don't recognize most of the places that I miss. And then I realized that is just the nature of our society now. We don't have villages that stay the same for 500 years. We have something that someone has to be able to build, make their money on. They build it so it will not last 50 years, and they have to tear it down and build another one to make money on.
Yeah, well, it's very much part of our disposable society.
Yeah. So if you have something in your life that you really like, hang on to it. Appreciate it now. Don't wait until I had this place. Enjoy it now, man. And if it's something good, it's going to go away. But if it's something bad, it'll go away too. It will change.
Well, you know, I had somebody tell me a long time ago, you know, even though I'm an atheist, I still kind of like the saying. He said, everything dies except God.
And to me, it's all what you define God as. And my basic thing is I'm incapable of defining that concept. I cannot put a name or a face on it. It's just a huge is. It just is. And I never understood putting names on God, because the purpose of names is to distinguish within a group of similar. You put names on people so you'll know who you're talking about. If you're talking about what I understand to be God, there's no one else. That's it.
We will return to your scheduled programming shortly, or we are currently experiencing technical difficulties.
And someone had given him a tiny little window, like about 10 by 12, of etched glass with colored glass and painted glass for Repent, Harlequin, said the TikTok fan. And he came to me and he knew exactly what he wanted. He said, I want this in a wall. I want a stained glass window of a church wall with this as the stained glass window in the window. So at that point, I said, how about cobalt blue glass with red chinking? Exactly. That's what I want. So I did the glass for him. It's still in his bedroom. It's still the only light coming in through one wall of his bedroom. But he then said, okay, what do I owe you? I said, well, here's the bill for materials. I would like to ask for a favor to be named later. And he got this look like he smelled something really bad. I don't like that. I said, Harlan, if I know anyone that has the ability to say no, if it's out of line, it is you. Okay, I can deal with that. And what happened was I sold my first book. I had already signed the contract and I had spent the advance. But I told Harlan what I want to do was have him look over the contract and give me notes on what I should look for in approving a contract. His personal assistant then was a woman named Linda. And the woman before that was named Maggie Pierce, who was an old girlfriend of mine. We were in a little group that, you know, I met her before she went to work for Harlan. And then when she went to work for Harlan, I was just suddenly connected to Harlan through the radio show Hour 25 and through Maggie. So Linda was Maggie's replacement and had just replaced her. Linda and Harlan sat down with my contract and on a 3-page contract gave me 4 pages of notes. And he did not know that I had already signed the contract and spent the advance. His first note is, don't sign this. This is worse than the contract that the Science Fiction Writers of America went on strike over with Avon Books. Oops. And I proceeded to start calling Donald Wolheim, Dahl Books, who had bought my book, drunk from California, explaining why they ought to give me more money because it's such a great book. And on about my third drunk call, he said, I tell you what, keep the money. I'm returning your book. I never want to hear from you again. So I then succeeded in unselling the first book I had sold. But Harlan did much more than I would have expected. A note, a page of notes from Harlan would have been priceless. He gave me 4 pages of them. When I wrote the book, the second person to see it was Donald Wolheim. Harlan had never read my book. But he said the person I needed to send it to was Lester Del Rey. And so I sent it to Del Rey Books. Lester and Judy told me, one, they weren't going to buy the book. They told me why. And Lester gave me 6 pages of notes on what he felt needed to be done to make the book sellable. And they were really, really good notes, but he only did that because I was recommended by Harlan. So I made the changes with the book, sold it to Daw, unsold it to Daw. It sat for about 10 years. When you came to visit in Burbank, where I lived across from the Equestrian Center, I was talking with Del Rey Books, and they have 2 lines. They have a fantasy line and a science fiction line, and they couldn't figure out how to market this thing that is science fiction and fantasy.
I remember that.
And the editor there gave me more wonderful polish on the book. And that book is now finally out. You can get it on Amazon and a couple of other sources. But you know, it's called Song of Orphans, and it is a much better book as a result of the input from Harlan and Del Rey and hopefully, I mean, Bridget Victoria. I can't think of her last name, the editor at Del Rey Books. But as a result, it's a book I'm not happy with the first five pages. And the first five pages, I think, are absolutely critical for any book. I'm still not happy with the first five pages, but they are much better than what they were before. I will stand by that book. That I wrote that book when I was 27 years old, living a post-hippie lifestyle before disco, you know, where I was, that was what I was doing. And my writing has matured, but that is a very satisfactory start point.
And going from Harlan, the other thing that I'm very grateful to you for is the Illuminatus trilogy. And, you know, I never even know where to begin with this book, because I remember the first time I read it, and
hurt your brain, didn't it?
Absolutely. I don't know if it was a copy that you had when we were living together, or if I went out and bought a copy myself. I don't remember. I do remember.
I think I had the red single volume.
Yes.
When I lived out in Phoenix.
Yeah. And then I went out and I picked up my own copy somewhere after that, and it had the blue cover.
Yeah.
It had all three books in it. Then I went out and got the Schrodinger's Cat's books and the mess, the Illuminati paperbacks as they were coming out, which weren't quite as good as the originals, but still.
Falcon Press was doing a lot of his work. I don't agree with everything he published, but he did a play called Wilhelm Reich in Hell, which was really good. And my favorite thing is in Hell, he was dealing with Marilyn Monroe, and they were asking her about committing suicide. She's dead, and they're interviewing her about committing suicide. And she says, well, I didn't think I had committed suicide, but after hearing all you people, maybe I did.
One of the things that I still have, and I've moved around a lot over the last 25 years, one of the very few things I still have from back in the late 80s is a copy of Principia Discordia.
Yeah.
And we picked that up. We were at an Army-Navy store out on McDowell. And I think you were looking for pants or something. But they had a book section. And for whatever reason, they had a copy of Principia Discordia. And I picked it up. And that's kind of been almost like my Bible since then.
Well, the one I've used as a guide for my religious stuff has been Zen Without Zen Masters. Mm-hmm. Which is Kenan Benares, which is also part of that whole thing. Terry Thornley, the guy that wrote Zen Without Zen Masters, also wrote a book about Oswald that was published 2 years before Oswald killed Kennedy. He felt Oswald was someone people should be paying attention to. His family will not allow the book to be republished. It was only done in an edition of like 100 copies.
Oh, wow.
But it was published before the Kennedy assassination. So Brownlee, right there, Kerry Thornley is very interesting to me, but I have a second edition. The first edition has this wonderful orange and red meditation cover, and he follows the kind of religious teachings that would have been dictated by a very strange philosopher named Wittgenstein. Are you familiar with him? Okay, because Wittgenstein said a perfectly good religion could be founded on nothing but jokes. And that's basically what Zen Without Zen Masters does. It's very short stories in there. One of the stories I like is Ho Chi Zen, who's a Zen teacher in San Francisco. He charged nothing for his sessions, but he had a nice big bowl by the door that said donations accepted. And he stood by the door and glared at the bowl while people came in. And finally, one of his students said, that really intimidates me. Why do you do that? And he said, anyone that donates three times in a row is dismissed for excessive gullibility. Now, that's a religion I can live with.
Yeah, I think I would probably be able to live with that, too.
You know, I find more and more I'm nowhere near the Buddhist I used to think I was. I'm much more Hindu than anything else, and I've gone more and more in the direction of following Gandhi. And I found the book on Gandhi that originally changed me when I was 17 years old. It was published in India about 1952. And it's a collection of short essays. And I'm contemplating doing that as a podcast where I can just read the whole thing and make it available. I'm contemplating some new podcasts also. We were talking about that earlier.
Yeah, let's talk about that just a little bit, and then we'll talk more about your books.
Well, I did some podcasts a few years ago, and it got to the point where getting the podcast produced was always a struggle and torment, and I had to meet a deadline and all this other stuff. I didn't have a deadline. I set the deadline. And then I started thinking about the way they do shows in England for TV, where they don't announce the show until it's produced, until it's done. They may tell you who's going to be in a show, but they don't really do the promotion until the show is completed. So when it's done, they then release each individual episode. One of my favorite English shows is Star Cops, about 1991. It was produced, I think, in 88 or 89 in England. It was shown in the U.S. in 1991. There are only 9 episodes. Finally, was able to locate the 9 episodes. 2 of them I had to piece together from fragments on YouTube. But they had all 9 episodes completely produced before they announced it. They've done that with the Sherlock series. They produce all the shows before they announce them and do publicity. But no matter what happens, the shows are going to come out because they're completed. If you've ever seen a show that got crippled because someone died during production, yeah, it doesn't happen with them. It just doesn't happen with them. So I'm thinking of doing what I'm calling burst podcasting, where I will wait until I have all of the shows produced, and then I'll start releasing them. And I'll probably do them in a little series of from 5 to 12 episodes, depending. I have a whole series of work I do that I do not put my name on because I consider them key to my survival and spiritual life. But the ones that I do put my name on, I'm thinking about doing one on Gandhi. I'm thinking about doing one on radio drama, which is one of my real passions. Old school comedy, and for me, old school is like 60s and 70s. And yes, some of the 50s. But there are things that I have a very strong interest in and I would like to release, but I'm not willing to put myself through that pressure because it's not real. I make the pressure myself. So just do it the way they do it in Britain and call it Burst Podcast.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I found out about podcasting when we started with the Supernauts. People seem to think who aren't doing podcasts that you just, you know, get on Skype or Google Hangouts or however you're recording it, and mm-hmm. and just record it, and that's it. You know, there's, you know, they don't think about the, you know, the sound editing that has to go on, getting bumper music, even just preparing for a show. Now, I mean, and I've known you for 27 years, but I still had a list of things that I wanted to kind of talk about because otherwise we get off on our own tangents.
Oh yeah,
which we've still done anyway, but it's
well, it's nice to get pulled back into the track. But I do. I run all over the place. Then one of my problems has always been I don't think linearly. I do not think linear. I think more systematic, and there may be 8 or 9 contacts within one topic. My favorite teacher, who is also the man that talked me out of being a teacher when I was 19. He inspired me to be a teacher and then talked me out of it because he said that I would have a class with 30 children. I would reach one of them, change their life, keep them from preventing suicide, and I would not see it, that I would only see the 29 failures go home and get drunk. Now, I hadn't even started drinking yet, and he saw that, which really makes me wonder about, I wonder if maybe he had a relationship with a certain man named William. I don't know. But his thing was that when you teach, realize, first of all, you're not teaching information. You're teaching for a harmonic. If you go into a music store and they have a row of guitars and the guitars have been tuned and you pluck the low G on a guitar, The other guitars that have been tuned to a low G will resonate and begin vibrating. And when you're teaching, that's what you want to do. You want to create the resonance that will then lead them on. When you get one piece of information where you had no pieces of information, it's like receiving one die, a set of dice, singular is die. So you have one six-sided die, which means you now have contact with six things you did not know before. And every time you learn something new, you get six more contacts with what you don't know. So the more you learn, the dumber you feel, because now you're aware of how huge it is, a topic, and that you really just barely know any of it. And I've talked to people that have won Pulitzers and Nobels, and, Tyson came in an hour 25 years and years and years ago, when he was a young upstart, astronomer.
Mm-hmm.
And Stanley Kaufman from the Griffith Observatory and all these other people, they all seem to channel through JPL or the Griffith Observatory before they move into really big positions. And they all say the same thing, that the more you learn, the more you know there is to learn. And that's one of the great things about continuing your own education. I think self-education, Isaac Asimov said, self-education is the only type of education there is. So for me, a topic implies contact with dozens of other topics related to that moment. So we may say, we're talking about Mike Nesmith, which immediately gives us television, music, personality, movies, the way he conducted himself individually. People have all kinds of weird stories about him, that he was already rich when he went to the Monkees because his mother invented liquid paper. Well, his mother did invent liquid paper, but she did not make any money off of it until after he was through with the Monkees. And he didn't get his hands on it till he was pretty well through with the Pacific Arts Project. And that's when he started getting into his political, think tank type stuff with Guizon. So he made it on his own. He didn't make it because of his mother. That's just something people like to say so they don't feel like they're such a loser for never doing anything. His first thing was writing a song called Different Drum, which was Linda Ronstadt's first hit with a group called The Stone Pony. And he has done that song Different Drum seriously, but on the Monkees, he did the most seriously screwed up version of Different Drum you're ever going to hear. Some guy with no rhythm at all, you and I travel to the beat of a different drum. We can't you tell by the way I run. And just,
that sounds like Bob Dylan.
Stop it! You're hurting me! But anyway, he takes his own work with a great deal of humor. And he does some serious work, too. But like I say, every topic we've talked about, Harlan Ellison. You can't talk about Harlan Ellison without talking about the dozens of other writers he's affected. And he makes no claim on anyone that he's helped. He was in Los Angeles during the earthquake, I think in 94. I think a really big earthquake, I think it was 94. He was in the valley. He lives up on the top of the valley of McCoy Drive, just off Mulholland. And his library is a two-story high room with a catwalk around the side with a second place to walk to get to the bookcases. He has 15 feet vertically of bookcases crammed. In the bookcases, there is a stairway that goes up to his private writing area, his office. Harlan writes in the nude because it's his house. That's how he likes to write. So he does. And the earthquake hit. And if you've ever been through an earthquake, they hit and there's a quiet and then they hit again. And usually it's one or two pre-shocks before you get to the big one. That may be in the space of 5 minutes. And when that stuff's happening, you will be amazed at how long 5 minutes could feel. Got the first shock. Harlan types on a manual, so he didn't have to worry about losing power. But he finished what he was writing, started down the stairs to go into the rest of the house. When he was starting down the stairs was when the big jolt hit. Books were flying off the shelves in the earthquake and beating the crap out of it. Now, one, we have a very badly damaged Harlan. And he wasn't married to his current wife yet, but she was already living with him for several years. They got him to the hospital, and it turns out it was just concussions, contusions, bruises, nothing serious. Got back to the house. The entire office Think of a room 20 feet wide by 30 feet long, two stories high, huge, beautiful golden ochre pool table in the middle, and nothing but shelves and places to sit. That's what the entire library is. It's all shelves and places to sit. And just about every damn book on the shelves had come off. Ed Bryant left Denver, drove for a day and a half, got to Hollywood, went to help Harlan put things back up. Several local science fiction writers. Larry Niven lives near him. Jerry Pournelle lives near him. Mercedes Lackey lives near him. And he gave her a really bad review in her early books, but she says they made her a better writer. She showed up like a washerwoman to help him clean up. And all these people showed up to help him, and he couldn't figure out why. He honestly did not understand that people care about him. He doesn't think any of his work gives him claim on anything. And I love that.
And that really speaks to the lie that people seem to have about Ellison. While he certainly does have an ego, it's not necessarily in the way that people think.
If you go up to Harlan and you presume on his presence, meaning you can tell him what's wrong with one of his books, or he owes you to sign a book that you bought that you want to turn around and sell on eBay, or if you come up with any kind of demand, if you haven't earned that, Harlan is going to let you know. But if you come up and you say, I read such and such a story, and I think it really changed my life. In Dreams with Sharp Teeth, there's a wonderful scene where Harlan's on the stage talking about idiots, and this guy gets up and starts talking, and the first thing Harlan says, are you an idiot? And the guy argues for a minute more, and he says, are you an idiot? And the guy says, yes, I am. Harlan says, really? And he left the stage. He came down into the audience to talk to this guy. And he said, don't let anybody talk you into being an idiot just so you'll agree with them. If you were an idiot, you wouldn't have the question. Okay? And then he went back to the stage and started back into the discussion. But they caught that on film for this movie. So when I tell that story, people can go to the movie and see it. You know, that's who he is. That's who he has been. People have hurt his feelings very badly. A lot of what he grew up with was not good. Little Jew Boy in Cleveland does not do well. But he survived. And he insists that the people around him survive. Respect themselves enough to do the work. That doesn't always mean you know how to have a life. Harlan's so lucky, man. He found a wife that can put up with him. And he's found many wives. But he's found one that's right there. She can go toe-to-toe with him. And they both protect Harlan. She did that when I went back to L.A. after I left Phoenix. I stopped by the studio because Harlan was in there doing a show. He was doing the show because when Mike O'Dell died, Harlan did the show for a year. The show I'm talking about is Hour 25 on KPFK. Harlan did the show for a year in tribute to Mike, and then he turned it over to some other people, and then they weren't able to do it. And Harlan came back and covered for a few weeks while he found someone else to take it over, and that's when it went to Joe Straczynski, Michael J. Straczynski, but we know him as Joe. And Joe took over the show, but Harlan was on the air that night. And I stopped by the studio to say hi. And I waved at him in the studio, and he waved at me, and they went to a show that they were playing from a tape or a record. And I went around to go in the studio, and his wife appeared magically in the sound block. He said, no, Harlan's working. And behind her, I heard him say, honey, it's Joe. Let him in. Oh, once he said, let him in, boom. It was right there. But that's kind of nice that, you know, he doesn't throw things when he sees me. I consider that a great triumph.
That's always the way that you want to be greeted by anybody, not having to duck flying objects.
Yeah.
Harlan in particular.
He is spectacular. He already has a body of work beyond my comprehension. We're talking about thousands of pieces of work, individual essays, stories, novels, screenplays, entire TV series. There was a TV series in the early 60s called Burke's Law. And that was Harlan's first serious series, Gene Barry and this very sophisticated detective. And he wrote most of the scripts for the show. He wrote the Bible for the show. You know, he was doing lots of things before they did, before he did City at the Edge of Eternity with Star Trek. Was that his City at the Edge of Forever?
Yeah, that was his.
Okay. But yeah, he had done a movie.
He had sued on around that one too, years and years later. Because he went through a series of lawsuits against pretty much anybody who he perceived looked at him cross-eyed.
Yeah, he did.
But
I will not argue.
But the thing is, I believe, for the most part, that was all in protecting his work and protecting himself as a writer, and not necessarily just a money grab.
Like what?
It was protecting himself as a writer, as opposed to like a money grab.
Exactly. That's what he does. Yeah. What he did with me, I had a lot of tapes I'd recorded at Hour 25. And this one production company in the Valley wanted to do a series of tapes because there was no internet, there was no CDs, there was cassette or reel-to-reel. And they wanted to release a bunch of tapes on cassette from Harlan Ellison, and they wanted to get the tapes from me. And I said, well, first of all, it's Harlan's work. I can't do that. Let me get his permission. And the guy gave me his offer. We'll sell them and we'll give you a 30% royalty. I went to Harlan and he said, you're new at this, aren't you? And I said, yeah. He said, okay. 30% where they don't have to record anything. They don't have to set up any studios. They don't have to negotiate anything. It's all just being handed to them. 30% is an insult. You tell them I get 60% or there's no deal. You will get 10% of the 10% out of my 60%. So he was willing to take 50% on the sales and allow me some money for doing it. And I said, I don't think they'll go for that. And he said, then they don't have a show. How does that hurt me? You know? So I went back and said 60%. They said no. And Harlan said, well, that's how it works. There was no animosity. There was no sniveling. There was no small-mindedness. This was business. And Harlan has a saying for that, too. He says, you're a writer. You're a creator. You honor that creation. But once you finish the job as a writer, you take that part of you and you tuck it away and you say, good boy, you've done really good. And then you turn around to do business and you bring out the fangs. You got to protect that writer.
And I think that's something that a lot of writers today don't see. And certainly don't do, particularly among the the indie or self-published writers, of course, present company excluded amongst ourselves.
I'm still learning how to do it. I really don't consider myself to know how to promote my own work at all. I'm learning, though.
Well, that's the toughest part is the promotion. God knows, I struggle with that. Since we're kind of on that topic, how has publishing changed for you from the old days when we used to have to send stories out on that we typed out, before the computers? Do you think publishing is more viable today than it was back then?
I'm not sure. What is changing is direct access to an audience, and that's a whole different kind of promotion. Before, when everything was run out of a few hundred publishing houses, books, magazines, newspapers, you had to go to a book stand, a magazine rack, a drugstore. But at that drugstore, you could find nonfiction, trashy fiction, classical fiction, magazines for damn near any topic, comic books, pulp magazines. There was, you had to leave to go get something. So ultimately, you only had to sell yourself to that audience of a couple hundred publishing houses. And then their promotion was to get it out to all those points of purchase that everyone had to go to. Now you don't have to do anything. And it's very hard to have to go and try to reach several hundred million points of purchase. It's a whole different animal. And I still don't think we have a good grip on it. There are times that I actually look at where we are moving in our communications. And I wonder, is that going to be good for the culture? And by culture, I mean literate, investigative, intelligent, questioning populations. I think that getting exactly what you want is not always a good thing. You wind up talking to an echo chamber where you only get your input from the places you already agree with.
And you don't learn to appreciate it either. If you have everything that you want, it lessens the value, it cheapens it.
Yeah, and you need to have context and contrast. When you would buy a science fiction magazine, you would have a story from Ben Bova and a story from Harlan Ellison and a story from Ted Sturgeon. And then you would have stories from three or four authors you never heard of in your life. Well, they can't be very good. So how does she think she is that she can get in this magazine and write, oh, that's not bad. But you get exposed to it. That's, you know, Dragon Riders of Pern, when it first came out in analog. I was like, you know, well, what's the big deal? You got a woman writing science fiction, so what? But she was writing excellent science fiction. My favorite science fiction author right now is Diane Duane. And I'm very upset that she hasn't come out with the fourth volume of The Tale of the Five. There are three books, Door into Shadow, Door into Fire, Door into Starlight. And the fourth book has been promised, but she will not release it until she can get all four books released again. She is a woman that completely blew my world away with less than half a page, where she's dealing with a planet where sexually people are required to work on having children. Women are required to have at least two children. Men are required to father at least one. Some have many, many more children than that. Beyond that, your relationships are your own. The most powerful warrior on this planet is this little blonde lady who has a husband that takes care of the kids and polishes her weapons. Two of the leads in the story are a gay couple who are magicians. And there is one woman who wants to become a warrior and spends everything in her life getting to the point where she can be the warrior she wants to be. This is all in the first book, by the way. What happens is, on this planet, you are told that once in your life, you will get to meet God. But you won't know it until later. And she and these two magicians farmhouse, and they go to the farmhouse, and there's an old lady working there, you know, taking care of the garden and all that. And, you know, they say that they've been walking and they're tired and blah, blah, blah. And they ask for a place to sleep for the night. And she said, well, I have one bed that'll hold two of you and then my bed. So we'll throw dice to see who sleeps with the old lady. And the other three are like, okay. And, turns out the young warrior sleeps with the old lady. The two men sleep together and the two women sleep together. And the next morning, they're talking about what she wants to do with her life. She wants to be a warrior. And the old lady asks her, says, well, do you know who you're killing? Well, I'm killing the enemy. Says, no, no, no. Do you know who you're killing? And she keeps giving all these appropriate but incorrect answers. And finally, the old lady says, okay, well, let's get some rest. And the next morning, they wake up and the house is abandoned. And has been abandoned for many years. And they realized that was their chance. They met God. And later the girl gets into battle and she kills her first combatants, the first enemy. And as she kills him, his face turns into the old lady looking terribly disappointed. And every time she kills someone, she sees the face of God, very disappointed. But the war goes on. And she has this man that's been following her. And he's been doing what this other guy did for the best warrior on the planet. He makes sure her blades are sharp. He polishes her armor. He takes care of her horse. He does all of that. And they're riding along this mountain trail. And she's thinking about, some people look for someone to love them for their whole life. And, oh my God, I found someone that loves me. And she twists around in her saddle and raises her hand to give a little wave to this guy that's been taken care of. And he raises his hand, and he's got this big smile. And when he lifts his hands from the reins, the horse missteps, and the horse and the man go over the edge of the cliff into the canyon from the trail. And in one half page, she took me from that level of cosmic joy of having realized she had someone who loved her to absolute despair and loss in less than half a page. Now, that's something I would like to do.
That's incredible.
I don't know if I've done that yet. I think I've come close with climbing the spiral mountain.
Well, let's talk about your work. We've spent a majority of this talking about Harlan and others. Let's talk about Spiral Mountain and what the impetus was for that.
When I came back to Los Angeles after living in Phoenix, it was not Triumph. Phoenix, I did not adjust well to. I had some very serious problems while I was there with some people there. I was barely able to stay employed through a temporary agency. And someone I knew in L.A. offered me a chance to come back and work and manage the office for his company again. I had done that before. And he said what he wanted to do is he wanted to sell the company. So everything was going to be focused on building up the client roster, getting the second, you know, the financing service, getting all the operators so they were good at what they did. We didn't have to keep hiring. We came up with a bonus program that I still am very proud of, where they worked for minimum wage plus a $2 per hour bonus for showing up on time. If you were late, your bonus dropped to $1.50 per hour. If you were late twice, it dropped to $1 per hour. If you kept not showing up on time, you were working for minimum wage. And at that time, minimum wage was like $4.25. So a $2 bonus was pretty significant. As a result, we wound up with a crew of operators that showed up on time and were happy to be there. So when I got back to Los Angeles, I needed a place to stay, and my friend Lauren let me come stay at his house. He had an extra room in the back, and I had the dream of being on a mountain trail with lots of other travelers, and we couldn't see each other because we were all wrapped up in these monk-like robes. And in the dream, someone fell from the edge of the path, and my character saw them almost go into a canyon. And I looked down and I realized that there was another trail below us, but it was a trail I had been on because this trail went all the way around this mountain. It was literally a spiral mountain leading you to the top. I looked up and I could see people moving on the trail above me, but there were only a few people right around me. And so I sat down and I wrote the opening pages of the novel. This is 1989. I wrote the opening pages to the novel, and they are still the opening pages of the novel. I would write dreams. I would write pain. I tried to be honest with it. And there's a lot of references to Alcoholics Anonymous in them, because I got to say, Alcoholics Anonymous has saved the lives of a lot of people. And I think it deserves to be included in the literature of the era. But the main story is, it's one man's struggle to define himself. And I use a very old cliche. He wakes up and doesn't know who he is. He finds a wallet with a driver's license, and it looks like him, but that name doesn't mean anything. And he finds a key ring with two keys on it, one for this old pickup truck he's driving, and one for this, you know, that's a door key. And there's an address on his driver's license. So he wakes up in a cafe and he asks the guy behind the counter, says, how do I get to Phoenix? And the guy says, oh, just go out there, catch the main road and, you know, head west. So he does. And he just has to follow these little clues. And he gets home and there are all these letters waiting for him. Condolence cards. I'm so sorry you had to go through this. I'm glad you went. All this other stuff that makes no sense to him. And it's how he generates a journey to visit the people that sent him these condolence cards and letters to try to find out who the hell he's been. So in that, he can find out who he is. And I think the journey to find out who you really are is something we all share. We have all tried on roles. We have changed our hair. We have changed our makeup. We've changed our dress. We've changed our food. We've changed our music. We've changed our politics. We've changed our slang so that we will fit in with people that we would like to belong to, because then we look like them and we smell like them and they like us better. But then we slowly come to that dissatisfaction that that's not who I am. And that real common fear most of us have, if you know who I really am, you'll leave. Mm-hmm. And it becomes very hard to tell people who you are. And I wrote the book. I got some of it done. And then I got to a point where I could not touch it without it triggering so much emotional stuff in me that I couldn't work on it. And then I would get back to work on the book. And I would get another 150 pages, 200 pages into it. And it would start triggering me again, where I just could not go near the book. It was like touching hot coals. When I moved to North Carolina, my life calmed down enormously. My whole life, I've moved. In my first 52 years, I had lived 64 places. In 1 year, I went from Phoenix to California, to Northern California, to Denver, and back. I had 5 addresses in 3 states. I've been in the building I'm in right now for more than 10 years, and I love it. If this building were to go away, if a hurricane tore it down or a fire took it, I now know how to feel at home, which is what I got to finish the book with. How do you find a place where you belong? And to me, the answer was very simple. You find the place this has invited you in, and you accept the invitation. I did it with my main character. I'm doing it with a new character where the journey is very different. I think, you know, my first book, Song of Orphans, is also about a journey. And I think that the books I like the best are always about the journey. And that's very... I did not get it from John Campbell, but it's very much in John Campbell's mode. I'm not trying to make my characters a hero, but I did a radio drama called Chapel Perilous, where I created several characters that were real enough to the cast that when the time came for two of those characters to go away, because those two characters were hallucinations this one guy was having in his own mind. The week that we recorded their last scene, all of the cast, the engineer, and I went into a depression because we had lost someone. We were never going to see them again. And when Chapel Perilous finally aired, I think it was in 82 on KPFK out in LA, there was a guy that was calling the station every 20 minutes. You got to let me talk to this guy. You got to let me talk to this guy. And they would call me at home and say, this guy's calling like every 20 minutes. You got to talk to him. And I thought, oh, someone's going to claim I stole their idea. I did steal the idea. I stole it from Dangerous Visions, you know, and I stole it from Carcinoma Angels, and I stole it from Doors Perception. And remember, if you steal from one place, it's plagiarism. If you steal from 5, it's research. But this guy wanted to talk to me because he was going through a lot of what the main character was going through. The guy was facing death, and all of this journey was how to avoid facing death. And it turns out you can't. And he was saying, I need to find out what's happening. I said, why? And he said, I'm losing my sight. I'm legally blind. My girlfriend just left me. And I'm sitting here with a gun in my lap. And I want to know if this guy makes it. And I was able to tell him. He makes it as much as any of us do. He's told in the story, he's actually told by death, you have a choice when you die, and that's what they put on your tombstone. What would you rather have? Morbid to the end, or we miss you? Chapel Perilous was playing in L.A. when I came back from Phoenix. A woman who did not know how to reach me had a show, and she wanted to feature it. And I went to the station because I heard Chapel Perilous. And she saw me, and she was terrified. Are you mad? Are you going to hit me? Like, I just went through hell. Do you have any idea how nice it is to come and find people appreciating your work? And it's like, it's really nicer if you can ask, but you had no way to reach me. So am I mad? No. As of now, you have the right to broadcast it anytime you want. But I came to LA and that was on the air, which amazed me. Somebody was actually listening to what I was doing. And they cared enough that they put it on the air. I found out it had been played one more time before that while I was out of town. And in Phoenix, I had a lot of stuff destroyed in that storage unit. And one of the things I lost were the master tapes for Chapel Perilous. So the only version of it is now up on archive.org. It's 8 half-hour episodes. It was originally designed in 10-minute episodes. And I was writing them in real time. We would get to the studio. We would do 3 10-minute episodes. And then later we linked them together into 1 4-hour production. And then we broke it into 4 1-hour productions. And the surviving version has 8 approximately 30-minute productions. You want me to send you the link for that one too?
I've got that. I've got a copy of that. You sent that to me a couple of months ago.
Okay, I was talking about the link on archive.org.
Yeah, that's where I downloaded it from.
Okay.
And I recommend anybody who has any kind of interest in radio drama or anything that Joe's mentioned about it to go ahead and treat yourselves and listen to Chapel Perilous. It's phenomenal stuff. It really is.
I'm sorry that the technical quality is not what we have. The surviving tapes were from the advanced mix. It's not the final broadcast version. It was the pre-mix. So there are places where the EQ doesn't work and the volume's off and stuff like that. But I've listened to it again, and once you get listening to it, my performers were really good. They created a world that only existed in that show. And in that show, since he's hallucinating this whole thing in his own mind, there's magic, there's science fiction, there's drama, there's nostalgia, there's haunting, there's terror. It's all there, because where else would our stories come from but inside?
And I think that really kind of encapsulates what I try to do with Imaginarium.
Well, and I will be watching it. I will be very interested in watching and see what you do with it, because it takes a while to find your sea legs and to actually develop something that you can identify as your own work. It's when I do a podcast. The first podcast I did, the first 5 or 6 ones, I was very tightly scripted, and I just read my narrations. And I could not just sit and talk, although I had done radio for years. I found something different in the podcast, and I wasn't quite sure what that was. But in a while, you'll be able to lay claim to your own creation so that at a later point, someone can listen to Imaginarium number 25 and say, oh, yeah, that's Imaginarium. That's how that is. I can identify it just from the tone.
I'm finding that with Supernauts. Well, the first 2 shows that we did with Supernauts, it was just the 3 of us. So, it's really kind of hard to judge this show as it is now compared to the first 2, because we have guests now, and we didn't on the first 2. Yeah. But once we started getting guests, this show changed.
And that's because the chemistry of reaction is very different from the chemistry of creation. And to me, the most value is when you can create during the reaction. I should tell you right now, you're going to hear something, and I don't want you to get scared. But I have a new addiction. It's not a new addiction. I've had this addiction for years. Diet Pepsi.
Oh, yeah.
I just popped a Diet Pepsi.
I heard that. And yeah, that's not new. You were a diet drinker as far back as I can remember.
Diet Pepsi and Diet Dr. Pepper. Love them both.
Although back then it was the Diet Cola from the Mexican supermarket. The grocery store.
Oh, their fountain version. Their fountain version.
They were Fiesta. It was the brand name.
I don't remember that. When I drink Mexican, I usually drink Humex, and I particularly love Guanabana. We have one decent Mexican restaurant here, a Mexicatessen, and I always get the agua frescas when I'm there. Like this one of the week last week I went into my restaurant and fell and damaged my left knee. That seems to be my new hobby, is damaging my left knee.
I can think of better hobbies.
And when I had my dinner there, I had agua fresca piña, which I love. But I also love horchata. I also love tamarindo. And sometimes you go in, you'll have agua fresca melon or agua fresca orange. And I'm a nut for that stuff. But as far as I don't remember Fiesta.
Yeah, it was, and I can't remember the name of the grocery store now, but there was one not very far from the apartment that you had on 11th Avenue in Camelback, and there was one just two blocks away from when we lived on Thomas and 18th Street. It was right on the other side of there wasn't a freeway then, actually, so it was like 22nd Street.
They had just started clearing the right-of-way to build the freeway.
Yep. Yeah, but I for some reason I always remember the 2 liter Fiesta bottles because they had some rather festive designs going around the side of the plastic bottle.
I really don't remember.
Yeah. I can remember that, but ask me what I had for breakfast this morning. Not a fucking clue. Well,
and my thing is I'm losing stuff. A friend of mine says his memory is bad and that every time he learns something new, something old falls off at the other end. So he's trying not to learn too many new things because one day what falls off at the other end will be something important like wiping.
That may be a good way to end the show. It's only been almost 2 hours.
Really?
Yep. An hour and 55 minutes.
My clock says, oh, well, that's right. We didn't start at 7. We started earlier.
Yeah, we started about 6:30 your time.
I was calling to check to make sure I had the right number. And we just started going. Okay.
Yep. So,
I think you'll be able to pull a solid hour, maybe even an hour and a half out of that.
Oh, definitely, definitely. There was a point where you were talking about Harlan. When you came back from the phone call, that I thought I had started recording again, and I hadn't, and it pissed me off because there was some really good stuff in there. So I'm definitely going to have to do some editing to make it all.
Yeah, and I've done that. Smooth. I did that. I was working on a family history, and I was interviewing people, and people who had lost a parent in my family group, mostly my cousins. I said, if you could say anything to her now, you know, what would you say? If you could say anything to him now, what would you say? And they were responding to it, and I would have the video running, but I'd forget to hit the microphone. Mm-hmm. So I have lots of really nice shots of my cousins looking sincerely at the camera, except two cousins that are never serious. You know, and they're saying something, and I'm trying to remember what they said. But then someone put the camera on me, and I did the same damn thing. I have video of me talking, you know, to the camera, and I have no idea what I was saying.
Well, usually I just forget to start the recording with CallGraph, but I remembered that. I just forgot to start it again. Actually, I thought I hit the button, but I guess I didn't click hard enough.
You weren't sincere enough.
I wasn't sincere enough, and apparently it wasn't meant to be recorded, so there you go.
Oh, well. They'll have to wait some other time to find out my wonderful pearls of wisdom.
Well, I will definitely have you back. And thanks, Joe, for coming on today.
Thank you. I really appreciated this. I enjoy this.
This was a lot of fun.
I just wish I could turn it into sales.
You and me both. And you can find links to Joe's work on our website at thesupernauts.com. And if you like Imaginarium, why don't you check out the other shows that we have on our network? And there's something for everyone and all guaranteed to entertain. Until next time, may all your journeys be filled with pure imagination.